It is Friday, December the 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, President Obama on the Islamic State's threat to the U.S.
Our partners on the ground are fighting to push ISIL back, and ISIL has been losing territory. We continue to do everything in our power to prevent terrorists from getting into the United States.
Also ahead, urgent need to alleviate migrant pressure in Europe. Plus, a hated U.S. drug company chief arrested. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Obama and members of his national security team met Thursday at the National Counterterrorism Center. That's just outside Washington rather than at the White House, as usual. After their meeting, Mr. Obama spoke to reporters referencing the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks. He emphasized what he said is his highest priority, the safety of the American people.
Here's what I want every American to know. Since 9/11, we've taken extraordinary steps to strengthen our homeland security. Our borders, our ports, our airports, our aviation security, including enhanced watch lists and screening. And we've gotten much better, thanks in part to the people in this room, of preventing large, complex attacks like 9/11. Moreover, and I think everybody here will agree, we have the very best intelligence, counterterrorism, homeland security, and law enforcement professionals in the world. Our folks are the best. Across our government, these dedicated professionals, including here at NCTC, are relentless, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. At the Operations Center here, people from across our government work literally shoulder to shoulder, poring over the latest information, analyzing it, integrating it, connecting the dots. They're sharing information, pushing it out across the federal government, and just as importantly, to our state and local partners. In other words, what you see here today is one strong, united team. So our professionals have a remarkable record of success. Of course, when terrorists pull off a despicable act like what happened in San Bernardino, it tears at our hearts. But it also stiffens our resolve to learn whatever lessons we can and to make any improvements that are needed. In the meantime, what the world doesn't always see are the successes. Those terrorist plots that have been prevented. And that's how it should be. This work oftentimes demands secrecy. But as Americans, we should not forget how good these patriots are. Over the years, they have taken countless terrorists off the battlefield. They have disrupted plots. They've thwarted attacks. They have saved American lives. And so for everybody who is involved in our counterterrorism efforts, I want to say thank you, and the American people, thank you. Now, I want to repeat what my team just told me. At this moment, our intelligence and counterterrorism professionals do not have any specific and credible information about an attack on the homeland. That said, we have to be vigilant. As I indicated in my address to the nation last week, we are in a new phase of terrorism, including lone actors and small groups of terrorists, like those in San Bernardino. Because they are smaller, often self-initiating, self-motivating, they're harder to detect, and that makes it harder to prevent. But just as the threat evolves, so do we.
President Obama speaking Thursday. Meantime, U.S. Homeland Security Chief Jay Johnson has unveiled a revamped terrorism alert system. Government plans to issue periodic bulletins, it says, will describe broader and more general trends about possible terrorism, situations the government considers something short of elevated or imminent concerns. Still ahead, nations looking to cut off the cash flow to the Islamic State militants.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
United Nations Security Council took aim at the self-proclaimed Islamic State's war chest on Thursday, unanimously adopting a resolution to strengthen and expand measures to cut off funding to the terror group. Resolution requires countries to increase their efforts to choke off funding to ISIS, as some call it, or ISIL, as President Obama has referred to it, which has seized large areas of Syria and Iraq and is looking to expand its stronghold in Libya. The measure also criminalizes a broader range of financial transactions to tie the hands of the terrorist and strengthens monitoring of sanctions violations. Meantime, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter is offering Iraq expanded U.S. assistance to combat the Islamic State. Mr. Carter, who encouraged Iraq to retake both Ramadi and the northern city of Mosul, has told U.S. lawmakers that Washington is prepared to provide advisors and attack helicopters to bolster Iraqi efforts to recapture Ramadi, the Anbar provincial capital, which fell to IS fighters in May. He also announced plans to deploy an elite force to attack Islamic State targets in both Iraq and Syria. All of this is encouraging news to Ambassador James Jeffrey, who served in post both in Iraq and Turkey and is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Affairs. He speaks here with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Anything we can do to increase the speed with which we take territory from ISIS is very good news. We're running into resistance from the Iraqi government, not because Abadi is opposed, but because Iran is doing everything in its power to stymie any cooperation between the Iraqi government and the U.S., even if that means letting ISIS hold on to places like Ramadi. I mean, it's absolutely infuriating. And on one hand, the Iranians say that they want to cooperate with us on ISIS, and on the other, this is what we see happens. Nonetheless, what Carter is doing is really good. I think the president really understands, our president, that he has to start producing real results on ISIS. He has not up till now.
What should be the strategy going forward, sir?
To seize terrain and defeat ISIS using all elements of American power, including, if necessary, some American ground troops, to prime the pump so that we get good ground troops from other countries. We can go in from Turkey. We can go in from Kurdistan. We can do this quietly. We can do it more openly. But we have to start taking territory from these people. That has to be the bottom line. The means have to be adjusted to the ends, not the ends to the means. And essentially, that's what we've been doing up to now, adjusting the ends to the means. The president didn't want boots on the ground. He didn't want casualties, either ours or civilian casualties. He didn't really want to get involved in fighting a war. And you see what's happened after 18 months of supposedly fighting a war against ISIS.
How's the battle going to retake Ramadi?
It's going very slowly. Some reasons for that are very understandable. We want to avoid civilian casualties. Another is it's a conglomeration of Iraqi forces. But one good news is that a lot of Sunni Arabs are in the fight on our side. And then finally, the Shia parties, again with Iranian support, have been trying to slow the thing down.
In a related story, the U.S. said it's withdrawing a dozen warplanes from the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. Just a month after they arrived, the Pentagon says no big deal. They were on a short-term mission. What say you, sir?
This is really curious. These were F-15s. Some of them were dual use, but most of them were air superiority fighters, and we put them in after the Russians flew their aircraft into Latakia, obviously, so that we would have the ability to escort our own fighters and, frankly, to respond to any Turkish request to defend NATO territory. Why we're withdrawing them at this time is a kind of curious thing in this campaign, Victor, that the administration hasn't explained why. They didn't have to explain why they were sent because we all could figure that out. We all would realize that maybe we wouldn't want to provoke Putin by saying we're flying them in so if necessary they can shoot down Russian airplanes. That I get. But why are we taking them out?
Pentagon spokesman says the deployment was always intended to be temporary and the decision does not lessen U.S. combat capability in the region and comes amid fresh commitments by France, Britain, and Germany. A dozen U.S. warplanes, along with unmanned drones, remain at Incirlik, as well as other warplanes from members of the U.S.-led coalition. This is VOA.
I'm Nilar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Rwanda is expected to vote yes in a constitutional referendum today that will allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third term in office. In 2017, there had been some increased pushback around Africa to the so-called Presidents for Life. VOA's Kim Lewis speaks with reporter Nick Long about the expectations of this referendum and why so many Rwandans want Kagame to stick around.
Most observers seem to think this is a done deal. They expect that, as in previous elections, that there will be a yes vote for the proposed constitutional changes, the main one being that the presidential term limits should be reformed. Currently, the constitution allows two seven-year terms to a president. The reform is to actually reduce that to 2 5-year terms, but to introduce a transitional period of 7 years from 2017, which is when the current president's term runs out, when the current president could stand again. So President Kagame could, if he wishes, and he hasn't made clear whether he wants to, but if he wished to, could stand for that 7-year term and could then run again for another 2 5-year terms. So he could, in theory, be in office until 2034.
Is this what the people want? Do they want to see him stay in power?
It's very hard to know. Rwanda's not famous for freedom of expression, but there's no doubt that President Kagame has a lot of support around the country for what he's done in the past 20 years since he rescued the country from genocide and built up the country from the ashes. And he is generally regarded as a model of developmental good governance. He's been very good for development and for providing public services, health services, and so on. And I think a lot of observers think that the ordinary Rwandan appreciates the peace, the security, and the public services that they enjoy under this current regime. So it could well be that if this were entirely free campaigning, which there isn't, but if there were, that Kagame would win.
What is the opposition saying about this proposed referendum?
Well, there is one major opposition party which is calling for a no vote, led by Frank Habineza. That's the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda. They're saying that while Kagame has been good for the country's development, they believe he should not stay on after 2017. They say that that would be a threat to peace and security, and that they believe he's given the country steady progress, but to maintain that progress and economic development, the country also needs to respect its laws, including its presidential term limits.
That is reporter Nick Long speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis, host of the program Africa News Tonight. And in other news, as of November, some 800,000 refugees and migrants from the Middle East and Africa have crossed the Mediterranean to reach safe haven in Europe. European Union estimates as many as 3 million might arrive by the end of next year. For the European nations, the migrant crisis is posing an unprecedented challenge from both humanitarian and security standpoints. VOA's Jane Bozniewski has more.
The flood of migrants into Europe is making it obvious that dialogue and agreement are necessary to better protect the European Union's external borders and substantially alleviate the pressure on affected countries. But as Edward Joseph of the Institute for Current World Affairs points out, those are difficult issues to manage. and are also politically sensitive.
So we have to have a balanced, wide perspective on this very pressing, urgent problem.
Luca D'Augiolo of the International Organization for Migration says it is important to help the migrants move on from the getaway countries of the Balkans to elsewhere in Western Europe.
What can be done to help all those refugees that are in countries of first asylum, where there are no opportunities for education, no opportunities for livelihood, no opportunities for a decent living?
The refugee crisis is stoking tensions among the countries on the migrant corridor. Slovenia has started to build a razor wire fence along its border with Croatia. Croatia's ambassador to Washington says the European Union needs to help alleviate those tensions.
There is a high awareness in Brussels and among the European countries of the fragility of economies in the Western Balkans.
Meanwhile, there is good news from Geneva. Government donors have promised an initial $690 million for UN refugees relief operations in 2016, the highest amount ever. But for Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia, managing the massive tide of humanity still presents a major political and security challenge. Jane Bojagievski, VOA News, Washington.
Controversial CEO of a U.S. drug company, Martin Scorsese, was arrested by FBI agents in Manhattan yesterday for allegedly operating a Ponzi scheme where he defrauded investors in one company and used the money to pay off investors in a hedge fund that he managed. But it turns out that he was also the buyer of a one-of-a-kind album by the rap group Wu-Tang Clan. International Edition's David Burr discussed the case and its implications with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee.
So about a year or so ago, we were hearing that the Wu-Tang Clan had released this album that they were going to put up for auction. And they anticipated receiving millions of dollars for this album because they were making only one. They weren't going to release it beyond the one. They wanted it to be sort of like any other work of art. It was rare and high quality and therefore expensive. So we found out that this piece had been purchased for $2 million. And I mean, it's not just the CD, it's packaged beautifully in a silver and nickel-plated box. It has a 174-page manuscript with lyrics and credits and backstories. And then there was also part of the deal, an agreement that the buyer had to wait 88 years before he or she could release the album to the public. So this was a huge deal, and we all wondered who bought this album. Martin is probably one of the most despised people in the world. So when we discovered recently that he was the one to purchase the album, we thought to ourselves, now what will the Wu do? Because, as you say, they try to be as responsible as they can. They obviously are very concerned about the community. That's what their whole repertoire really is about, is telling the stories of their community. And so RZA, who is one of the more outspoken members of the group, came out and said, number one, they had no idea who he was, what he was up to, that he was involved in hiking up the cost of pharmaceuticals, and now he's just been indicted on a Ponzi scheme. So that's recent. And so they were going to just donate the majority of the proceeds from the sale of the album to charity. So essentially, they're distancing themselves from this guy. And just a few hours before we came on the air, I read a story that said that Martin is not happy. And he thinks that they ought to show him a bit more respect. Because as of today, because of him, Wu has $2 million extra dollars in their pocket, which they don't. Because as I just said, they donate the money to charity.
Well, the thing is, too, that he was in the news previously because he jacked up the price of a drug that is used to fight toxoplasmosis. He's the head of a pharmaceutical company.
Right, right.
And he jacked up the price from $13.50 a pill, $13.50, to $750 a pill because he said it costs a lot for research and development.
Yeah.
It got to the point where even Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton said, we have got to do something about price gouging by big pharmaceutical companies.
Sure.
A backhanded reference to Mr. Shkreli. Whether he will last long in federal prison is another question. But again, in the United States, you're innocent until proven guilty. But as you mentioned, the FBI took him away in handcuffs in Manhattan for being part of a scheme where he defrauded investors in one company and tried to pay off investors in another with the money he got from the first group.
Yeah.
It's called a Ponzi scheme. What do you think? Let us know. You can send a tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send one to me. I'm David_DBird. That's BYRD. And, of course, you can log on to our website, voanews.com.
Now we're going to take a moment to check out the online reactions to the Shkreli story. Our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here. Tell us about it, G.
Hi, Steve. Shkreli definitely got scrutinized for increasing the cost of the anti-infection drug Daraprim, but that is not why he got arrested.
Tell us more about his arrest.
He got arrested Thursday morning on securities fraud related to his former company, Retrofin. This is what Phil Mattingly from Bloomberg tweeted. Martin Shkreli, pharma bad boy / exclusive Wu-Tang record owner / self-proclaimed most famous Albanian ever arrested. He's on Twitter at Phil_Mattingly and covers the White House for Bloomberg Politics and Television.
So, any other tweets?
Another TV personality, Carol Roth, also tweeted about Shkreli. She wrote, by the way, will they accept a Wu-Tang album as bail? He recently spent millions on the only copy of the Wu-Tang Clan album that music fans would love to hear, but he told press he doesn't plan on listening to it anytime soon. Moving on to the impact of the latest news. Business Insider tweeted shares of his company Daraprim is down 50% following the news. Steve?
Many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You can check out G on Twitter. Her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Nearly 4,000 people from 50 countries recently converged in Cairo for Egypt's entrepreneurial summit designed to bring investors, small business owners, and entrepreneurs together. This year's theme, Rise Up, focuses on technology-driven businesses. Ahmed El Alfi is the founder of Sawari Ventures.
We're trying to create a supplemental pillar of the Egyptian economy, to be an additional pillar from manufacturing and tourism.
Egypt has a 13% unemployment rate, so Dave McClure, founding partner at 500 Startups, sees a lot of untapped business opportunity in the country.
In other geographies around the world where we see similar size markets and audiences, there's usually quite a bit more capital at work.
According to Forbes magazine, global investment in technology startups was $12 billion in 2014. That's four times the amount the year before. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time to look at musical artists who are out on the road making money. Whether it's superstar Ariana Grande or an older rocker like former Beatle Ringo Starr or the country western hit band Lady Antebellum, being out on tour is how you pay the bills. And venues are popping worldwide right now with numerous artists on the road making money. There was a time when musical artists made their money from album sales and they toured largely to promote those albums. Well, that's all shifted since the advent of music downloads, which provide smaller amounts of income for the artist. Now it's the tour that counts, like Grande's current sold-out performances all over the world. At 21, Ariana Grande, who got her start on Broadway and TV's Nickelodeon, is just about as hot as a hit artist can be. Remember the Beatles drummer Ringo Starr?
What's my name?
just in case anybody forgot.
Well, at 74, Ringo's out on the road singing new songs and, of course, some old favorites like It Don't Come Easy. Like other legends of music, Ringo Starr stays ever so busy out on the road performing before packed houses.
You don't have to shout or leap about. You can even play them easy. Open up your heart together.
In the world of country western music, no band has Lady Antebellum beat.
This world keeps spinning faster until the disaster, so higher unto you, baby. When it all starts coming undone, baby, you're the only one I run to.
Lady Antebellum got started in the capital of country music, Nashville, in 2006. And like Ariana Grande and Ringo Starr, they have tons of music industry awards on top of an already very excited bunch of fans who follow them out on the road on tour. Making money, and let me tell you, those three make a lot of money. Superstar Puff Daddy is about to end a career. Talk about money. He's made a dollar or two along the way. He's going to end it as a recording artist, but first, performer wants to go out with a big bang by re-releasing his well-received mixtape, Triple M, which stands for Money Making Mitch. That'll happen on iTunes today. The mixtape serves as a prequel to No Way Out 2, Puff Daddy's final album to be released next year. The rapper born Sean Combs says after his recording career ends, he's just going to spend time traveling with his six children and decide what's going to come next in life. By the way, he has made a lot of money. I mean billions of dollars. Many thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned for the news. It comes up next for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Saif al-Adel is a fugitive and suspected high-ranking member of the Al-Qaeda terror network who was wanted in connection with the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and Nairobi, Kenya. He is an Egyptian citizen with black hair and dark eyes. He is also believed to be affiliated with the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. He is also known as Ibrahim al-Madani and Muhammad Ibrahim Makawi. Hundreds of people were killed in the embassy attacks and thousands wounded, most Kenyan and Tanzanian citizens. 12 Americans died. For these and other acts, al-Adel is charged with murder, conspiracy to destroy United States property, and other crimes. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Adel's arrest or prosecution. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
It's 4 hours.